We are in the condition we are in the state of ignorance we are in the state of war, in the state of economic depression, in the state of depletion of the resources of our planet because of the greed of psychopaths who thought they could create their own reality. Well, look at the reality they created.
You're listening to The Truth Perspective on the SOCT Radio Network, the world for people who think.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This is The Truth Perspective. It is March 26th. We are on the SOCT Radio Network, and in the studio today, we have Ilan Martin and Corey Schenk.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
I'm your host for today, Harrison Cayley, and we are going to be talking about the latest news that is all over the news, the terror attacks in Brussels. Now, just to start out with, you know, I mentioned this is all over the news. Pretty much any website you go to, any news website, you'll see dozens of articles about it. So it's all over the place. It's just saturating the airwaves. And just to give some perspective, there are and have been several terror attacks in countries all over the world in the last several months that have killed just as many people or more that we don't hear about, that don't make the headlines. And in fact, just I believe it was the day after, one or two days after the Brussels attacks, that there was a bombing at a football game in Baghdad, and where I think it was at least 30 people were killed, a similar number to the attacks in Brussels. And I think I saw two headlines on that. So just something to keep in perspective that people are being killed, you know, pretty much almost every day, every week in attacks like this.
Yes, but they're not white Anglo-Saxon people.
Right.
And therefore, they don't matter, mm-hmm. or at least not nearly as much.
No. But this has been... We'll get into this later, but this has been an ongoing thing for years, in fact, like decades. I read one article, you know, just kind of taking the mainstream perspective a bit, but pointing out that this is what Russia went through for years, you know, what Europe has been going through. Russia suffered these kinds of bombings and terror attacks for decades, and... as we'll see later on in the show, it really is part of the same kind of program. There are some really interesting connections to be made between those. But before we get there, let's just talk about the Brussels attacks a bit. These happened on the 22nd, so 4 days ago. So from following the news reports, there were three explosions. Three. Two at the airport, one at the metro. And so around 34, 37 people, something like that, or maybe 41. I haven't been keeping up on the latest figures, were killed in these attacks, and hundreds wounded. So very soon after the attacks, of course, it's making the news, and the CCTV footage is apparently leaked. It wasn't the first instance of it being posted was from a news channel, so it wasn't from the release from the police. A news channel somehow got a hold of this still, it's, you know, famous by now, showing the three individuals. There's the two guys dressed in pretty much identical costumes, with basically like light kind of khaki pants, a black jacket, and with one. Both of their left hands are gloved with black leather. And so these guys look very suspicious if you just look at it. It's kind of like it's kind of over the top if you think about it. I watched a couple of interviews with Sabelle Edmonds that she's given in the past couple of days on the attacks. And she just pointed out, I agreed with her. When she first saw it, she was like, oh, this is just ridiculous. I mean, these guys are... it's so obvious that it looks planned. Like if you have a real, if they're, if, if you're part of a terrorist cell and you want to do something, you don't make yourself obvious like that, right? It's like you don't draw attention to yourselves. They should be wearing like chic, trendy clothing to kind of mix in with the crowd. But these guys, they're what are they called? The costume designers, or they're what do they call it in the movie business? The wardrobe guys. The
wardrobe guys is good.
Yeah,
that suffices. CIA wardrobe department.
Yeah, and then like an hour after the picture was released, the police officially released the picture. So there's some question on how that picture was released, if it was some kind of airport security personnel that released it. Well, and funnily enough, like we had an article on SOT pointing out the connection with ICTS, who does security for the airport at Belgium, at Brussels. And this is the Israeli security company that just happened to run security at the airports involved with, what was it, the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber, I believe. And so, who knows, maybe these guys, got the clip and released the picture. But since then, so there are these, so apparently three guys at the airport and two people at the metro. Now, whenever something like this, one of these attacks happens, it's really hard to know who you can believe and what you can believe that comes out in the news, because it's just text on a screen, right? It's hard to, unless you have an actual interview with a person, it's hard to know who's saying what, where they're getting their information. One of the accounts that seems pretty legit to me is that there was a taxi driver in Brussels who drove three guys to the airport, and then after he saw the CCTV footage, the screenshot basically, he called the police and told them everything he knew, because two of these guys were people that he had driven to the airport. Now, so right away, I think that from reading this guy's account, it's pretty believable, unless, you know, I can't really think of a good reason why he'd make anything up. So I think we can probably trust what he had to say. But what he did have to say is that he picked these guys up at an apartment, which was later raided. These three guys, they had five like big bags of luggage, and they were too big to fit in his cab, in his taxi. And so he told them, well, you're going to have to leave two behind. And so they were kind of unhappy about that. But they left behind two bags. They brought them back up to the apartment and just decided to go with their three bags. Two guys sat in the back of the cab and one guy sat in the front. And the two guys in the back he identified as the brothers, Khalid and Ibrahim. But oddly, Kalim, they are saying, was responsible for one of the metro bombs. But he says he drove both of them to the airport. So either the police account is wrong, or Khalid originally went to the airport and then left to subsequently go to the metro. And the third guy, he says, was in the front seat. And he said he was really talkative, and he was ranting on the way to the airport about about America. He was saying like how bad America was and how bad America is to Muslims, and then he dropped them off at the airport. He said that there was like suspicious powder on their bags, and they didn't really say anything to kind of like, he thought they were kind of suspicious, but they didn't really say anything to make him too suspicious. But he dropped them off, and then like I said, only after seeing the picture of them did he come forward. And so he identified them as the two al-Bakrawi brothers. And the third one, he identified, this is the guy in the picture with the tan jacket and the hat and the glasses. And he identified him as this guy, Faisal Chefu, I believe his name was. And this guy was kind of like an independent journalist. He's got some videos on YouTube of him just kind of going around and interviewing people and doing some pieces on the Muslim community in there. But strangely, this guy, the like before this came out, just in the last 24 hours, first of all, the U.S. said that they knew who this guy was. They said, oh, well, we know the guy in that picture, because apparently, I don't know, maybe they they recognized him from, maybe John McCain recognized him from all the times that they, you know, that he talked to him on the phone and Skyped with him, and, you know, he's got a lot of pen pals in the jihadi business, so who knows? I'm guessing it was McCain that identified the guy, but they didn't say what his name was. And then after that, police were saying that they thought that this guy was guy named, I think, Albrini or something, and he was wanted in connection with the Paris attacks, and they've been looking for him. I can't remember the exact details of who this guy was, but then this taxi driver says, no, this is the guy, and he identified him from photographs, apparently. So just some details to being added into the narrative to be watched and kept in mind as more details come out. It's always interesting, I think, to watch how the story unfolds, what details change, and what stay the same, and just to kind of try to get an idea on what can be actually verified or you know, just believed as being an actual fact. It's very difficult, as I mentioned.
Another detail, it seems pretty pertinent, was the fact that these attacks occurred so closely after Salah Abdeslam's arrest.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, the mainstream coverage reports that, you know, this man was, he was arrested and he was connected to the Paris attacks that occurred last November. And, you know, the mainstream coverage says that he was, you know, the ISIS fighters decided they had to act now in order to act before, you know, he released any information that would, you know, that would bust their mm-hmm. operations. You know, whether that's true, you know, and, you know, if that's just a narrow truth or part of a much broader truth of, you know, the real operations that are going on is hard to say, but it's definitely a part of the, you know, the official narrative right now is that they, you know, they've started springing their attacks. And
yeah. And I think it's very interesting that that the arrest happened so close in proximity in time to the terrorism in Brussels. It's as though there is this connection trying to be projected into the minds of people. Remember the Paris attacks? So now you have this big news item about the arrest, and then no sooner than we hear that than the attacks in Brussels. So this connection, this narrative bite gets reproduced for people all over again and reinforced.
And not to mention the very suspicious nature of the arrest, as Harrison wrote about in his article, about the fact that the police were after this guy. And I mean, they've been after him for months, right? They've had this huge crackdown, and they've been, you know, allegedly they've been hunting him down, but they tracked him down, and then he fled, and then they managed to find him again based on a suspicious pizza order that was placed by a woman in the neighborhood. You know, she's ordering pizza for 30 jihadis, and the police are on that, you know, like wild.
Well, there's an interesting thing with that story, and it comes back to the Bukhari brothers, because as soon as these guys were named as suspects in the Brussels attack, like, what was it, the same day or, you know, within 24 hours, probably less than that, I can't remember exactly, the first reports that came out said that these guys had previous ties to organized crime, and those details were later revealed. They were, both of them had been arrested in 2010 and 2011, one of them for opening firing on police with an assault rifle, and the other guy for a carjacking and having a stockpile of assault rifles. He was supposed to get 4 years. Apparently he didn't serve his entire 4 years. He was let out a year or two later, after which he went to Syria, 2012 to 2013, and then got back into Belgium. So these initial reports said that they had been previously known as connected to organized crime, but with no known links to terrorists. Now, this has subsequently been shown to be a complete lie for a number of reasons. First of all, the most obvious is that this raid on the that resulted in Abdeslam's arrest. What had happened is that these that the Belgian police had raided an apartment where they thought, you know, that or that they thought it was an empty safe house for this terrorist cell. You know, I don't know if I believe that, but they so they raid this place. They get in a gunfight with one guy, this Belkade guy who had been previously wanted in connection with the Paris attacks, and two or three other guys were apparently in the apartment, but they ran, they got away. They escaped by like, you know, going out the back and jumping on rooftops and getting away. So these three guys got away. Now, when that happened, these three guys got away. And in the news, this was on March 16th, I believe, 6 days before the Brussels attacks. You can read it in the, in, it's either the Independent or the Telegraph had a report on this. And they said that the suspects involved, two of the guys that they believe that were running away, were the Bakrawi brothers, and they named them. This was they were in the news a week before this attack. Mm-hmm. Now, if that isn't a tie to terrorism, I don't know what is. These guys were not only like they were suspected of being in the place with this guy and with Abdeslam, because Abdeslam was one of the guys that escaped along, you know, after this raid, and they were publicly named as being the suspects of. You know, of running away from this police raid. They were in the news already. So that was just ridiculous. Just to finish the story, they had this raid where the three guys escaped, and then they were so, and they thought that they were pretty sure that one of them was Abdeslam because they allegedly found his fingerprint on a glass in the apartment and some DNA. I don't know, maybe some saliva or something like that. Who knows? But then I believe it was the next day they were checking out this other place that they suspected, this other apartment that they suspected was being used, that was holding a large number of people, they thought. So it was suspicious. And so they were casing the joint and kind of watching it. But then the final straw was an unusually large pizza order that was placed from this apartment. So the woman that was living, either owned or was renting this place, made an unusually large pizza order, and they said, you know, bang, we got them. There's people in there. And so they raided the place, they walk in, or they storm in, and they see this woman drinking tea with her two daughters and Abdeslam. So, I mean, just picture it. I mean, probably munching down on pizza at the same time.
Well, everyone knows that the favorite food of jihadists around the world is pizza. Mm-hmm. That was a shoo-in clue. But, you know, this patsy narrative that we see, this pattern over and over again, it couldn't be more obvious anymore at this time that there is this narrative created in the media, and it's always, oh, the security apparatus, the police, you know, they knew about them, but they weren't tough enough. They weren't assertive enough. They were just on the cusp. They were aware of them. They had warnings about them, but they didn't quite get to them in time.
They just don't have enough power. They don't have enough surveillance.
So let's give them more.
The one that got away.
Yes. And of course, this is trying to feed into this idea, you know, problem, reaction, solution. The solution, what's the solution? We have to go after them with even more verve and vigor. We have to imprison more of them. We have to, you know, close the borders and imprison more of them. And so the takeaway is, you know, these narratives are synthetic. They're manufactured. I wouldn't be surprised if this shootout that happened just days prior to the attacks that you mentioned, Harrison, were somehow shaped or created precisely for this reason.
In order to create this dynamic rolling narrative, so to speak.
Yeah, and the narrative is always the same. It's like they've got one script and they've just realized which one works, and so they're just reusing it. Because in all of these cases, in all these attacks in the last years, the guys involved, the suspects that they name, are always previously known to police and intelligence and have either been arrested or have some kind of ties with undercover police or direct ties with like the intelligence agencies. And that, again, that's the case with this one. So not only were the Bakrawis wanted in connection with this previous raid a week before, but I believe it was Ibrahim had gone to Turkey last year, in June of last year. He arrived there on June 2nd, I believe, and then he was arrested at the Turkish border with Syria in a routine sweep of the area, and this guy's suspicious, so the Turks arrest him, take his passport, scan it, they keep him in prison for a month, and then on July 14th, I can't remember, they deport him to the Netherlands. Now, right as they deport him, they give his information and they tell the story to Dutch and Belgian officials. So they relate that this guy is a suspected terrorist and suspected of involvement with ISIS, because they caught him on the border, and you should keep him in put him in custody because this is a suspicious guy. So this didn't come out until a couple days a day or two after the attacks, and Erdogan and some other Turkish officials went public with the story and said, we warned you guys, we told you about him. And then the day after that, the Belgians admit it and say, okay, yeah, you did. And then the two of the ministers in the Belgian government offered their resignations, which were rejected, saying, oh yeah, it was just a failure. It was some guy in the Foreign Office, it was his fault. He didn't tell us, he didn't pass the information on. So they tried to pass the buck on that. But even if, let's just accept that as being what happened. I got no problem accepting that. The question, the weird thing, and it's kind of like the dog that didn't bark, but why was this guy arrested in the first place? It was the dog that did bark. The dog that did bark that shouldn't have barked. Why were the Turks, why did the Turks arrest this guy and deport him? Same thing with the other Ibrahim. This was Brahim Abdeslam, Salah's brother, who allegedly blew himself up in the Paris attacks. Both of these Brahims were arrested in Turkey and deported, and so were known to European intelligence because of this. But the big thing here is that what is Turkey known for? What have they been doing constantly for the past five years? They have been funneling terrorists over the border from Turkey into Syria. It's basically an open border for these guys. RT just put out, they're coming out with a documentary in the next few weeks, but they put out some details and some documents that they found before they're going to air the documentary. Some RT journalists went to some of the recently liberated towns and villages in northern Syria. These were the places that were held by ISIS, but were just taken in the past, in the past month or two. And so they were there like just 10 days after the Syrian army and the National Defense Forces had liberated these towns. And so they basically found them, in like pristine conditions. This was before any kind of cleanup operations. So they go into the official buildings and they just find just documents strewn all over the place. And not only that, they interview some of the ISIS militants who'd been captured and were in custody, and they interviewed these guys. So first of all, in the documents they found just like meticulous bureaucratic documentation of the oil trade. So they've got the number of barrels, how much these guys have, what truck or what vehicle they're using, how much money it was bought for, how much they're selling it for, etc. And then they found these kind of jihadi manuals that were written and printed in Turkey. They've got the address of the publisher on them in Turkey. And then they interview these guys. And so they ask them, well, how does it work? And they say, we come and go from Turkey. They let us come. They don't ask any questions. They just let us through. well, why do they do that? Oh, well, because they're kind of allied with us because we fight the Kurds, so they don't have to. So they're perfectly fine with us. There's no problem. And these guys were just saying that it's totally open. They have full ability to go to cross the border. So when you think about a guy like Brahim al-Bakrawi, why did he get arrested? Mm-hmm. It's not because he was suspected of terrorism. There's something else going on here. So I wrote in my article that it looks like in cases like this, these guys are kind of sheep-dipped, just like Lee Harvey Oswald with his mm-hmm. so-called anti-Castro leanings in New Orleans, mm-hmm. that there is a paper trail created for these guys. So Brahim was caught in Turkey. Okay, there's our tie to ISIS. And now this is the guy that we can kind of maneuver into this kind of position and do the job that we want him to do. Now, of course, there's so many details, so many just aspects of this that will be impossible to know. We can't know what goes on in this kind of world, this kind of milieu of spooks and terrorists. But we can know we can know the kind of general trend, the narrative that gets spun, the dynamics that we see just repeatedly. We can get the kind of big picture. We may not be able to know all the details, but so this is kind of what I think when I see anything like this happen, is that first of all, there's so much that we don't know, and yet the media and the government narrative is always so certain, and it presents it as just this fact, this kind of giant fact, and the response is there, the correct response that people should have, the correct interpretation of these facts. But even if a lot or even most of this narrative that gets told is true, it can be true, but that still doesn't tell us everything about what's going on. Because there's always a bigger context, and there are always details that get left out of the narrative that if we knew would totally change the picture. Actually, this reminds me of something that I just watched recently, this dynamic. It's about the 28 pages in the Joint Intelligence Report on Terrorism in the U.S. related to 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so these are the 28 pages that got redacted from it's not the 9/11 Commission Report, it's the Joint Intelligence Report. And so these have been off the books, classified for years. But in the last year or two, several congressmen have been able to read it. And actually, any congressperson or senator, I believe, is able to read it. But what they have to do is they have to go to a special building and might be in Washington. I don't know. But they have to be signed in. They can't take notes. They can't take any kind of photographs. They can just read the documents, and then they have to leave. They have to be escorted in and out. Now, the few that have taken the opportunity to actually read this have said, well, one of the guys said that, after every two pages, I had to kind of just stop and think and totally rearrange in my head everything I thought about our foreign policy and terrorism and the attacks on 9/11. Just totally, rechange everything, or just change everything, because there is something in these 28 pages that has that capacity. And for these guys, it's not like they were coming out and saying, oh, well, I found out that the whole 9/11 Commission report was a total lie. Well, not necessarily. These guys can totally probably still believe everything in the 9/11 Commission report, but it's these extra details that put all of that into context, into perspective. And what we think we know about these 28 pages is that they have to do with the funding for the operations. And some of the statements that these guys have made is that that foreign governments or foreign nations, plural, were involved in this. Now, the speculation has been that this is about Saudi Arabia, and it probably is, because there were links with Saudi Arabia in the funding of these terrorists. But it said foreign governments, plural. How do they put it? Foreign governments, plural, aiding the terrorists, the hijackers, on American soil. So that's kind of what these 28 pages apparently are about foreign support for these terrorist groups on American soil, so while they were in America. Now, if Saudi Arabia is one country, well, what is the other country or countries? Now, as I point out in my article, I think one of those countries is definitely Israel. how much information there is in those 20 pages, it's impossible to say because they're classified and no one can say what's in them and no one can read them unless you happen to be a congressman in the U.S. But just this point about the wider narrative or this greater perspective that puts the previously known facts into perspective. And that's kind of where I think we can go with this because, ever since the Paris attacks, Belgium has still been in the news because, of course, a lot of the guys that were involved apparently in the Paris attacks were from Belgium. And Abdeslam had, of course, driven some of the guys into Paris that night and then driven back that same night. And he was photographed at a gas station with this Albrini guy who was thought to be the third guy in this CCTV footage from the Brussels attacks. And then he'd been hiding in Belgium for the past 4 months, apparently. And since then, there have just been tons of raids. Belgium's been in the news, and the thing that sticks out for me is that Belgium's being called like the jihadi hotbed of Europe, the jihadi capital of Europe, that it's a hotbed of extremism and terrorism. And so I've just got a little bit of a little statistic here. According to the Belgian authorities, some 380 Belgian citizens arrived in Syria in order to join ISIS. So this is 380 Belgians that they know of that went to Syria. Now, this number, this is what makes Belgium the most so-called jihadi-infiltrated country in the EU. The statistics work out to about 34 militants per 1 million citizens, compared to Germany, 22 militants per 1 million, and France, 18 per 1 million. Now, that's what makes, apparently, Belgium the jihadi capital of Europe and the world, is these 380 guys that joined ISIS in Syria.
These guys who can't be caught, yeah. Despite the fact that they're always caught.
but first of all, there's a number of problems with this math and just this idea. Because first of all, these are 400 guys that are in Syria for the most part, most of them. Most of these guys are probably still there or dead. We don't have any idea how many have come back. And even then, 380, so 34 per million. Compare that with 18 per million in France. That's like, I mean, there's no difference between those numbers, really. It's the same thing. Like, there's nothing special about Belgium that makes it the jihadi capital. It's got a few more people that apparently have gone to Syria. It's ridiculous to use those words to call, like, to describe Brussels or Belgium in general.
Yeah, well, this is just like, you know, calling the whole event, you know, Belgium's 9/11. I mean, it's so ridiculous, but of course everyone is so terrified by the whole thing, which is what it's designed to do, that any kind of critical thinking on the subject has been it's been diffused because most people are buying it. Of course, it's those evil Muslims again. And I was thinking about this whole warning that Erdogan had given Brussels not a week before. You know, it could happen in Brussels, the attack. And it reminded me of a really scary episode of when I was a kid. My parents had this little boutique in a nice neighborhood, and three stores down was a fish store. And in New York, you have the mafia who is in charge of construction and drugs and laundering and the fish business. And as the story goes, one day, some guy from some mafia group in Queens and Brooklyn came to this fish store just three stores down from my parents' place and said, you know, we'd like a piece of the business. And the owner said no. And the guy said, it would be a shame if something happened to your place. But the guy refused to give up any part of his business. Anyway, one morning in the wee hours, there was an explosion in the fish store. And the whole neighborhood knew that it was the mafia. And I remember thinking, I remember actually being terrified that such a thing could happen. In any case, it's no different. Erdogan is he's the Al Capone of the Middle East. His mentioning the threat of Brussels getting bombed or attacked, and then it happening, and then basically asking for extortion money from the EU for keeping refugees inside of Turkey is absolutely no different. So just bringing it down to that level was kind of a huge reminder of what this dynamic really is.
Right, and it wasn't just Turkey that provided, you know, warnings to Belgium. Russian officials have come out and said that they provided detailed warnings that this could happen. And Israeli media has revealed that, you know, Belgian officials had precise warnings about these attacks occurring. But you have, like you said, this narrative that has come out that is based solely around the fact that, you know, this is a Belgian problem because they are this hotspot of terrorists because, you know, they haven't been there hasn't been a good integration, or, you know, Belgium is a failed state within Europe, is, you know, that's what they're saying now. But, you know, they're completely neglecting some other really critical aspects of the story. Little minor details that, you know, you wouldn't think would really mean much. But, you know, that when you kind of put them together, you know, really tell a lot about the story. And considering the day of the bombings at the EU Parliament located there in Brussels, they were meeting, and one of the things they were going to discuss was how to coordinate their anti-criminal, like mafia type activity, how they were going to coordinate, you know, organized crime to fight organized crime. But then also that day on the 22nd, they were going to meet to talk about the Palestinian human rights situation. And the Palestinian foreign minister was arriving to discuss, you know, basically the apartheid state in Israel. Then, of course, you had the attacks that occurred, you know, right there, sending a pretty loud message to everyone in all the elites, you know, everyone who was invited and would have been in attendance. And afterwards, you had an Israeli official come out and waste no time in saying that the recent European Union law regarding the labeling of goods produced in Israeli settlements illegally built in the occupied Palestinian West Bank was a big factor behind the bombings. Just like you said, I mean, it's the exact same dynamic. They just come out with a very thinly veiled mask on. You know, right. You can hear it, and you can hear it in the text in the articles. You can hear them basically gloating. You know, you can hear, you know, just like Erdogan's, you know, predicting this attack would occur, and then afterwards saying, oh, you know, now we should probably get that safe zone that we wanted in Syria for our terrorist groups, right? You know, that'll solve every problem, right?
Plus another 3 billion.
We just need 3 billion more euros.
Well, just to give some context on what we're talking about here, I mean, for regular listeners, I mean, you've heard it all before, but for anyone that might be new to listening to the program or to SOT, there, when you hear Muslim terrorism, it's not that simple. Really, Muslim terrorism has been a tool of Western intelligence and geopolicy for decades. Now, just to give a little bit of context, I just started reading this book, came out 2014. It's called Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. It's by J. Michael Springman. He was a State Department official, a U.S. diplomat, in the 80s, in 83, I believe, he was posted to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Now, when he was there, he kind of describes his experience there as being somewhat surreal, just because it was so strange. Like, first of all, he got there and he realized that way more people at the consulate were CIA agents than he'd expected, probably higher than average, because CIA always has people kind of embedded with State Department and, you know, undercover of being certain kind of officials in the State Department. And that's normal and everyone knows it. But usually it's kind of like maybe one in a three, maybe one in two people are CIA officials or agents or whatever. But in Jeddah, it was much higher. According to his statistics, he thinks that probably 85% or something were CIA or NSA. There were very few actual State Department people there. And when he was there, it was his job to issue visas. Now, Jeddah received 45,000 visa applications a year for people wanting to come to the United States. This was in the early 80s, remember. And he found that he would refuse a lot of visas because these people were clearly not qualified for a visa. They didn't have ties to Saudi Arabia, maybe. They were suspicious, you know. They might want to go to the U.S. to visit some kind of trade show for, you know, tied to the Commerce Department. They were going to an automobile production, you know, trade show. And when he asked them, okay, well, what's the name of the company and where's the town where the conference is being held? They couldn't answer. So he'd refuse these visas. Then these guys would say, well, no, I need that visa. And so they'd go and they'd talk to another guy at the consulate, and he'd give them the visa. He had his superiors tell him, no, you have to issue these guys visas. You can't, you know, just do it. It was only later, like, he had no idea what was going on. It was only later that he realized that this was what he was doing, and what the people there were doing were issuing visas to mercenaries to go to the United States to train in order to be sent to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets in the Afghan War. So I just want to read the first paragraph of the book. He says, Al-Qaeda, Arabic for the base, grew out of and became identical with the Arab-Afghan Legion. Those terrorists recruited by the United States, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. Originally sent to Afghanistan, they fought the USSR's army and air force following the Soviet Union's invasion of that country. Later, the CIA directed them to cross the border and destabilize the Muslim republics of the Soviet Union. Still later, the American government moved them into the Balkans to destroy Yugoslavia, and then similarly to Iraq, followed by Libya and Syria. They received visas to travel to the United States, usually from Saudi Arabia, for training, debriefing, and other purposes. In enabling their passage, American government officials violated the Immigration and Nationality Act, as well as the State Department's regulations codified in the Foreign Affairs Manual. I know I was there, I issued the visas, and I objected to gross violations of law and regulation. As a result, as happens to nearly all whistleblowers, I was fired. So he goes into the details in this book. But just remember this, that from 1979, if not earlier, until 2001, Al-Qaeda was directed, supported, created by the United States. On 2001, that one day, Al-Qaeda was the enemy and acted against the U.S. And then pretty much directly after that, Al-Qaeda was again our ally in all these countries, and is again today in Syria, for example, as the Al-Nusra Front and Daesh, because ISIS came out of Al-Qaeda. These are all the same guys. They were created, they were all brought together, trained in the 80s, and it's just been the same guys, you know, with new recruits along the way, just being shuttled from one country to another, and they've done the exact same thing in every country. Afghanistan, the southern republic, the southern regions and countries around Russia and in Russia, Yugoslavia, Libya, Syria.
Well, it sounds like a really similar dynamic to what happened back in the 60s. It was with the Bay of Pigs invasion, where Cuban exiles, were brought into the States. The CIA basically initiated this huge operation to, you know, topple Castro and to take him out. And U.S. officials were largely unaware of what was going on. They'd be asked to, sign off on getting some doctors sent to a specific base, you know, to help train these exiles. But they didn't know what was happening. This was all the result of a secret team, you know, as L. Fletcher Prouty describes it, which is the common denominator here. You know, throughout the decades, you see, whether it was in, you know, with Cuban exiles and the horrifically botched Bay of Pigs incident, which just, you know, could have just been because they were, you know, just so inept and they weren't able to actually pull off the, you know, the airstrikes that they needed in order to actually secure an invasion. And then you have a similar dynamic play out in Belgium's history with the Stay Behind Gladio network that that was British and American and Belgian after the fall of the world or after World War II or during World War II. They created an army to fight the Nazis. And, you know, then the CIA got involved afterwards eventually and, you know, basically turned it into their own beast. And it's, you know, up into the 80s, they were carrying out a string of massacres, basically just to terrorize the people, to get them to accept a right-wing government and to, you know, just destroy democracy, essentially, to terrify the people into accepting, you know, right-wing power. And so these groups,
This was under the pretext of fighting communism.
This was fighting communism, which is what got them out of a lot of legal hassles. You know, that's what shut down a lot of the investigations, was the fact, oh, you didn't understand what it was like back then. You know, when all the information started coming out in the 90s, when investigators were starting to ask, you know, especially during the Barbank massacre, why are there's these ties to the secret army that was left behind? And you had numerous investigators come out and look at, you know, the murderers, and especially the investigation itself, which was shut down numerous times. Different paramilitary groups surfaced with ties to Belgian military circles and, you know, police. They were involved in financing and being the active militant arm of the Stay Behind network. And, you know, so from 1982 to 1985, the most notorious unsolved crime spree occurred in Belgium, thanks to this Operation Gladio. And the reason really that it's unsolved officially is because they were basically from on high, from NATO headquarters, which is where Brussels is located, you know, which probably is a significant contributor to the reason they are a hotbed of terrorist activity. Exactly. Considering all of this picture that you gain about Al-Qaeda, you know, all of these subversive mercenaries all working for NATO's, you know, imperial arm.
So in a sense, this is where the title for today's show comes from, why Belgium really is a hotbed of extremist terrorists. It's not only a hotbed, it is terrorist, it's the terrorist capital. It's their headquarters.
Yeah,
but it's not in some little apartment in the Muslim neighborhoods of Brussels. It's in NATO and EU headquarters.
You know, and this is not unlike, I think, getting back to the analogy of 9/11, you know, the planners, the real planners of 9/11 attacking the Pentagon. Except, you know, the difference is that there wasn't any kind of physical attack on the buildings of NATO or the EU buildings, but it's right there. And so it's this other kind of deflection away from these power centers that are actually in control of all of the terror. And, you know, when you put together all of the support that the CIA gave to the Mujahideen and all of these mercenaries and people who were fighting in Afghanistan against the USSR at the time. And, Corey, you went even further back to the 60s. I mean, what we're seeing today is the kind of fruition. It's the ripening of what was for many, many years this very covert war on the world and democracies.